Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And surely the government does not want you to know that it's in the pocket of the nation's pharmaceutical companies. That's right, the drug companies that sell you all those wonderful products they're advertising on air for distress and other concerns. Well, they are making a fortune off the government. They give tens of millions of dollars to members of Congress, to the Bush administration, and they get hundreds of millions of dollars in return. And later on in the hour, we're going to have Taylor Lincoln of Public Citizen. And he has studied the flows of money back and forth, the quid pro quo, if you will, the something for something that's given and gotten between the pharmaceutical companies and the Bush administration and members of Congress, and how they're trying to hide the ball. That'll be the topic on for the rest of the hour. He'll be on in about 10, 15 minutes. But before we get there, I want to talk about the debate tonight. Everyone listening to my voice knows that the last presidential debate will be held in Tempe, Arizona tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And in that debate, I suggest that John Kerry has a chance to pull ahead of George Bush and never look back. You see, prior to this point, the Republicans have focused primarily on foreign policy. Indeed, they do that for a reason. They do that because polls show, rightly or wrongly, I say wrongly, that George Bush has an advantage on foreign policy over John Kerry. The people overall support George Bush over John Kerry on issues like the war on terrorism. Now, when you get to specifics like Iraq and things like that, they're less sure. But overall in foreign policy, George Bush has an edge. And that's why the Republicans have focused on foreign policy really for the last 2 months. And it's also why in the debates, the Republicans insisted that foreign policy come first. But now is really Kerry's chance to hit the ball out of the park, to find out his views on domestic policy. And polls show that on domestic policy, whether you look at jobs or health care, the environment or education, John Kerry has a better plan than Bush's. The people of the United States believe already that Kerry's plans are better than George Bush's. And so if we look at the debate numbers, I think a lot of people were surprised by the fact that John Kerry so sweeped George Bush in both debates. A lot of people talk about the first debate where, sure, there was a 20 to 30 point margin of people that felt John Kerry won that debate. But even in the second debate, as new polls are coming out, as people have reflected on what the president did or did not say, the fact that he lied about his timber company or didn't know about it, and the fact that some reports are coming out that there was a mysterious rectangular item hiding underneath the president's sport coat that some suggest might mean that he's wired for answers. As these things start coming through, the polls are showing that John Kerry won the second debate as well by 10 or 20 points. So he's got his work cut out for him. At this point, people think that Kerry's going to win the third debate. Latest Gallup poll I saw showed 54 to 36% think Kerry's going to win. And I think Kerry can win and will win hands down. The American people are already where he is on domestic issues. And that's not just jobs and health care. It's even social issues. Things like abortion, civil rights, gay rights. It's interesting to me And you know that if you listened to my show yesterday, Election Tuesday, that issues like abortion still are the deciding matter for a lot of people. For the solid people in the red states, Bush's supporters, the fact that he believes that a woman having an abortion should be prosecuted as a criminal, and some would say as a murderer, that is the reason why they want to support George Bush. And all the rest, all the stuff about foreign policy in Iraq, it's just an excuse to support the person that they want to support because of his stand on abortion. If you go to Bush rallies, which, of course, I wouldn't be allowed to go to because we know that Bush doesn't allow anyone who supports Kerry to go to his rallies. He doesn't even allow undecided voters to go. If you go to Bush rallies, what gets his biggest applause line? His support of a constitutional amendment that prevents states from giving gay people equal rights in marriage. That gets the loudest applause. It's very interesting to me that of all the things the Republican Party stands for, denying equal rights to gay people gives them the greatest applause. So these social issues still matter, and it will be interesting to see how Kerry deals with them. By the end of the day, I think what the undecided voters care about, those few percentage in the middle that are not strong Democrats, strong Republicans, it's not the social issues. If it were the social issues, they wouldn't be undecided. It's the pocketbook issues. It's health care. It's jobs. And Kerry, he's got a bit of a difficult road because he has to walk a fine line between the people that say, Kerry, you're droning on and on, giving us far too many details, and you're putting people to sleep, which is half the audience, and the other half of the audience that says, Kerry, you say you have a plan, but you don't spell it out. Hey, anyone can say they have a plan. Kerry, what's yours? Now, in a sense, that's an impossible thing to do, right? To give details of your plan, but not go on and on in a way that bores people. But I actually think Kerry can walk that tightrope. And the way to walk that tightrope is simply to give a few details of the plans. You know, say the specifics. No, I don't believe in government-run health care. Yes, I do support ending the tax credit for offshoring jobs that Bush wants. Yes, I believe in increased Pell Grants so that America's kids can go to college. And just leave it at that. And again, he can always cite his website for more details. I expect John Kerry will do that. I think, in fact, it's what he did so well in the first debate when he said, for example, I haven't been flip-flopping on Iraq. What I've said has been very consistent. I authorized the president to go to war because Saddam Hussein was a threat, but I think he went about it the wrong way. And just leave it at that. I really think he has a chance to hit the ball out of the park because if you look at the latest polls, and I watch these things very carefully, Kerry has consistently been increasing in the polls, doing better and better and better. And I think they're just about even right now between Bush and Kerry, but I think that's largely because undecided voters are waiting for the domestic issues. Traditionally, it is the economy, stupid, as they said in the Clinton campaign. It is the economy, it is domestic issues that decide these campaigns. And I think Americans will be looking very carefully, particularly the undecided, to hear the Bush-Kerry plans. And we already know the Bush domestic agenda has failed, whether it's the amount of jobs lost, the first president since the Great Depression to lose jobs in his 4 years, or health care costs going through the roof, or not funding education. We know America's rejected Bush plans. I think they'll have an open mind for John Kerry, and I think if John Kerry puts in a good performance tonight, you will see those poll numbers change. You will see him cross the margin, cross over George Bush, and go all the way to victory. So I'm optimistic about tonight, and we'll, of course, be talking about the debates tomorrow. On tomorrow's show, we're going to go into detail who performed, who did well, why, what things you agreed with, what you disagree with. We'll have a full discussion of that tomorrow. But I want to now move to our topic of today, and that is pharmaceutical companies, drug companies, healthcare. Healthcare costs are going through the roof. You know it. I know it. You don't have to look at the latest statistics. It's simple. Whether it's the cost of paying for drugs, the cost of health care, hospital costs, they are growing much higher than inflation, their highest rates ever. And one of the things I think people will be looking for tonight in the debate is how each of the candidates talk and deal with health costs. But there's a lot that's not being discussed, and that's why I wanted to give you the inside scoop today on how drug companies are busy paying off our members of Congress trying to get what they want. What is the quid pro quo, if you will? What is the quid? What's the money going to members of Congress, and what's the quo? What are they getting back for it? Well, my guest, Tato Lincoln of Public Citizen, he knows. He studied this issue. He's been examining the money flows. He's been looking at the organizations set up by pharmaceutical companies, and he'll give you the evidence, or lack of evidence, you can discuss it with him, on how much pharmaceutical companies are controlling our government and what they're getting in return. If you want to call in, it's easy to do. Just dial toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. If you just like numbers, it's 877-577-2667. Or you can do as so many of you already have today and comment on the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com. Say whatever you wish to say. We'll be reading some of your comments on the air. But first, I want to welcome to the program Taylor Lincoln of Public Citizen. Taylor, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, thank you for having me, sir.
Let me just ask you, I want to get something out of the way here because I know it may be a concern for some of our listeners. Public Citizen, I believe, was formed by Ralph Nader, but you don't have any connection with him anymore.
That's correct.
Right?
We were founded by Ralph Nader in 1971. He has not been affiliated with our organization since 1981.
Okay, and so you haven't endorsed a candidate. You're a nonpartisan group, is that right?
We are a nonpartisan group. We don't endorse candidates.
Okay, I just wanted to get that out in the way because regular listeners know I'm not a big fan of Ralph Nader. I actually think he's helping George Bush a lot in this election. For what reason? I guess only Ralph knows. And I just want to make clear that Public Citizen is a very respected organization and relates back to the good days of Ralph Nader and not to whatever he's turned into right now.
Well, I think that's how a lot of us feel. I think there's a lot of ambivalent feelings here because there's a lot of admiration for Ralph Nader. We would rather he's not running for president.
I like the old Ralph Nader. You know, the new and improved to me is new and definitely not improved.
It's been a big point of emphasis for us to point out to our members that it's not Ralph Nader, a Public Citizen, that's running for president, but he's doing it on his own because our members give us contributions, membership dues, to go out and fight for regular folks, be a watchdog over the government, and so forth. They're not expecting us to be running for president ourselves or being involved in electoral politics ourselves.
Fair enough. Now, you have done specific research on pharmaceutical companies and how they're giving gifts to Congress. Is that right?
Yeah. The specific research that we actually did is on the pharmaceutical companies giving, and other organizations, by the way, giving money to front groups that go out and do the bidding for members of Congress. However you feel about normal campaign contributions, they are limited to $2,000 in election cycle right now and are subject to full disclosure. If the contribution is over $200, that's called hard money.
Okay.
We like hard money. And corporate money, by the way, is forbidden.
Okay.
We favor hard money as a form of campaign contribution. The work that we do here in our campaign finance oversight practice focuses on soft money, and there's gradations of soft money, but the most recent study is on groups that are registered within Section 501C of the tax code.
Okay.
And this is sort of the softest, murkiest, stealthiest money.
Okay.
It's completely unregulated and it's completely undisclosed.
I want to explain some of this because I don't want to get people lost in the tax code here.
Yeah.
Hard money is money given by individuals. You give up to $2,000. Right,
right,
per candidate. And this is, and I, you say you like hard money. I like hard money too, because hard money let me take that back. I prefer public financing of all campaigns. That's my first choice.
As do we. Right.
Okay. But given that we don't have that system, we have an imperfect system, hard money is better than soft money because there's an individual, they have their name attached to it. It's not, if I have stock in General Motors, then I don't want General Motors doing anything but making cars or making money for my stock. I might not want them to give to George W. Bush since I'm not a supporter of his. I don't like corporations using my money without my approval.
Sure.
So when I give individually, I can say I support whatever candidate I support. I can give to specific issues. I can give to pro-life or pro-choice groups, depending on my stance on abortion. It's my money. I get to decide what I support. It's not somebody using my money really against my will, which is what corporations can do with money that I'm investing just to get a decent return on my money, not to support an individual candidate.
Well, and corporate influence in elections has been illegal as a matter of government law and policy since Teddy Roosevelt made it so in 1908.
It has been illegal, but we have seen how they work to get around that illegality. We've seen how Tom DeLay, for example, has been doing this in Texas, using Texas corporations to launder money. That's why he's in trouble criminally there, and hopefully that they're going to pursue that. But we've also seen in soft money people getting around these regulations. And I guess I'd like to start by asking you, Taylor, you got Corporation X, if you will, and Corporation X wants money from taxpayers for whatever reason. How can Corporation X give money to members of Congress when you have this law that says corporations can't give money?
Well, what they can do is run advertisements that either praise that member of Congress or, often as not, paint the person's opponent as the next coming of the devil.
Yeah, evil and wrong and so forth.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Now, they have slight restrictions. They can't say, vote for Smith or vote against Smith.
Okay.
But they can say, call Smith, the opponent, and ask her to stop murdering children.
But, Taylor, I thought McCain-Feingold got rid of some of this kind
of
stuff.
Well, what it did is it forbade contributions directly to the parties. Our studies, it happens, talked a lot about 2000 and 2002 when those contributions were still legal.
Okay.
But that is true. These organizations cannot give money directly to parties, but they can give money to the 527 groups you've heard so much about, the
right.
Swift votes and so forth.
Right.
In those cases, it has to be disclosed, but they can do the contribution.
Yeah.
And they can give money to the 501c groups, which are a sort of unknown haven for corporate money because there's just so little disclosure.
Well, let's give an example. Let's say Pfizer, and I don't mean necessarily to pick on Pfizer, though
sure.
I don't need to praise them either. They're a major drug manufacturer. Let's say Pfizer wants to get a lot of money back from the Bush administration. How would they go about helping George Bush in a way where their fingerprints maybe wouldn't be shown so well?
Yeah, my guess is what they would do and what they have done, frankly, is less to helping George Bush and more to helping members of Congress.
Okay.
But say you've got a really close congressional district.
Okay.
You know, that's going to come down to a 50-50 vote. Maybe it's a redistricted district pitting two incumbents, as we saw in a few cases in 2002.
Yeah.
And they come in and spend a couple million dollars. For instance, these groups went in and spent a couple million dollars against Representative Holden in Pennsylvania, who was in a tough fight against George Kikas. And if that candidate ends up winning by 51-49, one would suspect that that candidate is going to be pretty receptive to that industry's point of view.
Now,
Big Bill.
In the case that you mentioned, George Kikas and the Democrat was
sure.
Holden, they supported the Republican over the Democrat. Do we find that the pharmaceutical companies tend to support Republicans over Democrats?
We looked at four groups that we have identified as groups that we either know or strongly believe are front groups for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Three of them exclusively favored Republicans.
Exclusively?
The fourth one, United Seniors Association, which was the biggest of all, it was something like 21-4 in terms of the 25 candidates on whose behalf they intervened. And interestingly, of the four Democratic candidates that they helped,
yeah.
three of them were in races that weren't even competitive, whereas of the 21 Republicans, nearly everyone was in a very competitive race.
Okay, so they're supporting Democrats.
Like they might have intervened in a few races that weren't competitive, almost to throw off the scent, to
right.
say this isn't a front group for the Republican Party.
So to break it down, three of these organizations exclusively favor Republicans. The fourth, in terms of statistics you gave, 84% Republicans, 16% Democrats, but three of those four Democratic races weren't even close. The people didn't even need the money.
So, well, it was 21 out of 25 Republicans. I guess, oh,
right.
you did the math real quickly there, didn't you?
I can multiply by four in my head. It's one of the advantages.
Good for you. Good for you.
But yeah, in other words, there's one Democratic race
right.
out of
that
all
was
of them.
In 2002. They're back again in 18 contests that they did ads in right before September, which is a new deadline. There's a little bit different rules this year. And it was, boy, I don't have the chart in front of me, I believe 14-4 Republican to Democrat. So basically, USA primarily supports Republicans, although to be fair, they do support some Democrats, and not all of the Democrats they support are in blowout races. A couple of them, for instance, Congressman Matheson in Utah, they supported. He was in one of the closest races, and they did help him.
Now, why do they overwhelmingly favor Republicans?
I'm not sure I can answer that question any better than you can.
Okay.
I mean, that wasn't really the focus of our study, but I think that our hypothesis is, and we have a great deal of evidence that I'll be going into it in terms of why, the pharmaceutical industry overwhelmingly is the funding source of USA, and the things that the pharmaceutical industry wants, the Republican Party was willing to give them, and the Democratic Party wasn't willing to give them.
Okay.
I think it's as simple as that.
I want to explore those issues in detail, exactly what they're getting. I want to talk about the Medicare bill that was passed about a year ago. I've talked about on the air some of the really strange stuff that was going on, holding the vote open all night, threatening to bribe a member of Congress from the – this, again, this came from the very top of the Republican
right.
Party. I want to talk about all these things and really try to understand, if you will, as a case study, how does this work? How does an industry – and in some ways it's broader than just pharmaceutical industry, clearly – how does an industry pay off a member of Congress – and get something back, and what we the people can do, if anything, to stop it. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can do as so many of you have and comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Americans, U.S. corporations say that they are no longer offshoring our middle-class jobs. It seems that they've grown afraid of the rising public anger at this self-serving fattening of their already ample bottom lines at the expense of working families. They fear that there will be a political backlash from workers, customers, Congress, and plain old American patriots. Does this mean that greed-headed CEOs are no longer shipping our manufacturing, professional, and high-tech jobs to India, Pakistan, Russia, and other low-wage centers? Of course not. It simply means that they no longer say the word offshoring. Instead, the doublespeak artists of corporate PR departments have coined new euphemisms. Rather than offshoring, they now call it remote global sourcing or right-shoring to disguise the perfidy. A new report finds that offshoring, by whatever name, is not only continuing unabated, but accelerating rapidly and expanding into new fields. If you're an architect, if you do legal work or tax preparation, if you're an editor or radiologist, say bye-bye to your professional position, for CEOs are putting these and many more on a virtual boat overseas, with about 80% of the jobs going to India, where they can get the work done for a third or less than they pay to us Americans. The report, prepared by Forrester Research, says that offshoring is increasing dramatically. Forrester's previous prediction was that the U.S. would lose 588,000 jobs to offshoring by the end of this year. Now it estimates that 830,000 will be lost, a 41% increase. Nearly half of corporations surveyed say they're either offshoring jobs now or preparing to. Well, says one offshoring specialist, so what? Quote, it's free enterprise. We're trying to make money. Yeah, and so are bank robbers. This is Jim Hightower saying the proper word for what these CEOs are doing is not offshoring, it's stealing. They're stealing America's middle-class future.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, and we're talking about drug companies and what they're doing to gain power, gain money, and take taxpayer money. And I guess there's a little bit of irony there that we just heard an advertisement for Pfizer and for Viagra. I don't like to attack our advertisers, but that's, again, part of the problem, right? It's people being afraid to go out and attack people that are advertising. What are they advertising? They're advertising Viagra. Now, look, I have no problem for people that have, you know, sexual impotence and need the drug, but who's kidding who? Most of us who are out there know a lot of people are using this drug, not so much because they need it because they're impotent, but because it's become almost a party drug. And what we find is that drug companies are doing their best to sell all kinds of mood-altering drugs. We have mood-altering drugs that are illegal, right? Things like marijuana, cocaine, crack, heroin. But then we've got things like Prozac and all kinds of different drugs that affect your serotonin levels, much like the illegal ones. Only these have a lot of advertising on the air. One of the things that I find very interesting is when you turn on the TV, and I forget what product it was, but they're these two sort of eggs, and they look depressed. And how can you be not depressed? Well, don't do good in the world. Don't be happy in your job. Don't help your family. No, take this drug, and you'll be happier. And I remember thinking to myself, well, is that so different from cocaine or crack or heroin or anything else? And yet, drugs that actually save lives, whether it's AIDS drugs or cancer drugs, those prices are going through the roof. And I guess my first question to you, and we've got a lot of things to talk about. My guest is Taylor Lincoln, a public citizen who studied contributions of drug companies to Congress, is do you think this is just a coincidence that all the drugs I see advertised are these mood-altering drugs, and I don't see too many advertisements for AIDS drugs or cancer drugs, or do you think it has something to do with drug company policies?
Well, it is not quite my area to look at the inner motivations of the drug companies. However, we here have done a fair amount of work on the comparison of the direct-to-consumer advertising, which probably doesn't result in saving a whole lot of lives, versus research and development and so forth. And the numbers are staggering. We found that the collective drug companies spent $2.7 billion with a B dollars advertising, direct-to-consumer advertising in 2001, according to a Harvard-MIT study, which take that and then you compare that to our $41 billion to tilt a couple elections, and the $41 billion suddenly doesn't sound like so much.
So they spent $2.7 billion on the advertising. How much did they spend on research? Do you have that figure?
I don't have that figure.
Okay.
It's hard to break out. But, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have that figure.
That's okay. My understanding, though,
figure, but I don't have it.
That's okay. Maybe you can find a commercial. But my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the money spent on advertising is greater than the money spent on research.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. And when they're doing this, again, they're raising drug prices to unheard of amounts. As I've seen the statistics, and again, I don't know if you have this information, Taylor, but as I've seen it, the markup on these drugs, it's not 10%, 20%, or even 100%. Sometimes it's 1,000%. Sometimes they're charging 10 times what it takes to create a drug, or even 20 times what it takes to create a drug. Does that sound right to you, Taylor?
Again, it's not quite my area, but we've certainly seen examples of not only high markups on the cost of drugs, but even cases where a drug has already gone to market and yet its price has continued to increase annually at rates several times the rate of inflation.
Okay.
In such a way, they've already got the drug, it's on the market. You know, a television tends to get cheaper over time, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
Once you've kind of figured out how to make it.
Sure.
And they figured out how to make the drugs, and the drugs have gotten more expensive. And, you know, obviously that's become a really big issue with Americans, is why do these drugs cost so much money?
Again, the number, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. I guess my question for you, Taylor, though, is how do the politics affect this? How is it that Congress or the FDA or any government agency helps drug companies make these tremendous profits?
I think that the big thing you have to look at is the willingness of Congress to give the drug industry what it wanted. And I think that your example of a case study of looking at an industry essentially investing in Congress and then getting a return on its investment is really apt. The Medicare prescription drug bill issue has been around for, you know, years, if not decades. And for the longest time, the pharmaceutical industry opposed it because the proposals that were being put forth would put restrictions on them, cost them things that they didn't want to give up. And what they did is sort of realized that Medicare prescription drugs were going to happen. The Republican Party, which had opposed it in the past, came to endorse the idea. And it was a sort of collective effort between the Republican Party and the pharmaceutical industry, where the Republican Party said, we're on board. The pharmaceutical industry said, let us give you a lot of money to draft this legislation in a way that we like. And in the summer of 2002, there was a startling point where the Republican Party held a fundraiser that raised $30 million, $3 million of which that night came from the pharmaceutical industry companies. And the fundraiser was hosted by a president of the pharmaceutical company, GlaxoSmithKline. Okay. It was that same week that a Medicare prescription drug bill, made to order by the pharmaceutical industry, was introduced in the House.
Okay, now when you say made to order, did you think the pharmaceutical industry actually wrote the bill?
I can't say that they actually wrote the bill. I haven't seen, we've certainly seen a lot of cases in the last few years of lobbyists drafting legislation and regulations. I don't know if the to what extent the pharmaceutical industry actually put pen to paper on what the House ended up taking up. But the certain things that the pharmaceutical industry wanted have received a great deal of publicity in the last 18 months or so. And the two big things that a lot of Americans are familiar with is that the pharmaceutical industry was able to get Congress and the administration not to legalize and easily enable Americans to order drugs from abroad. The so-called drug reimportation that would let you order your drugs as you might from a catalog, like you might order clothes from a catalog from Canada, where the price can be 50 or 80% less than what you pay for drugs here in the United States. And the other huge thing that the pharmaceutical industry wanted was that any Medicare prescription drug benefit not be accompanied by a policy of the government negotiating with the drug companies on price.
No, because God forbid, that would actually make it cheaper for Americans to get drugs, and we can't have that.
We can't have that. Well, you know, times are great. Times are so good.
Right, right, exactly. There's so much money. Everyone is so rich.
The surplus. We can't. Oh, wait, the surplus is gone.
Yeah, largest deficit. Yeah, it does make a problem. Let me go to the phones, though, because they're lighting up. I want to hear what my callers have to say. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Taylor Lincoln.
This is Ed from New York.
Yes.
And I'd like to ask your guest about how much money the pharmaceutical companies gave to the specific Republican congressman who passed the Medicare Act, which provided that we couldn't get, as he just suggested, the drugs from Canada at a cheaper price, and provided also for a payment to the drug companies.
How much did they give, Taylor?
I'm afraid I don't have that number. I could look for that when we're on a commercial.
Okay.
My study had to do with the pharmaceutical industry giving money to front groups.
Okay.
That did the bidding for the pharmaceutical industry.
So basically it's how they hid the money.
Yeah. Now, it should be noted the industry itself can't give money to members of Congress, but their executives can give money.
Okay.
And that is probably an obtainable figure, but it's not one that I have at my fingertips.
Okay.
Do we know which executives gave money from, or can you give us some of the companies, the names of the companies that the executives gave money?
Well, the study that we did this time around focused on contributions from the Pharmaceutical Trade Association, which is known as PhRMA, giving money to these front groups.
So, is that legal, Taylor?
It is legal for them to give money to these groups.
So the front, the grouping of companies can give, even when the individual companies can't give?
No, either the individual companies or the grouping of companies can give to the front groups.
Oh, can give to the front groups?
Yes. Now, neither could give directly to members of Congress.
I see. And so the front groups are the ones who are spending the money on the campaign,
right,
and so forth.
No, that's not to say the drug industry executives haven't contributed liberally to members of Congress.
I understand.
Sure they have, as well as drug industry lobbyists, but that's not a figure that I have at my fingertips.
So this is the way they basically get around the law.
It's a way. You know, it's not so much just getting around the law, but the way that they give money to groups like United Seniors Association and 60 Plus, the effect of that is that it masks the pharmaceutical industry's role. If you see a commercial from a group called United Seniors Association,
you don't realize that it's Pfizer or Glaxo or any of these other companies.
You think this is a spontaneous uprising of concerned citizens, you know, a grassroots group. Now, if I told you that that group had $25 million in revenue in 2002,
and it didn't come from seniors,
$21 came from a single source, that
I
doesn't sound like, you know, Max or, you know, Florence down on the corner.
I hear you. Ed, thank you for your call. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Taylor Lincoln.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
How you all doing?
Good. I know this is Brian.
I'm from New Jersey.
Yeah, hey, how are you, Brian? What's
I'm
your question
right.
or comment?
Basically, I mean, I know all the problems. I see these commercials whenever I tend to watch TV, and I think it's an outrage that they can just, you know, advertise. You don't even know what's going on. You're, like, running through a field, and then all of a sudden there's a unicorn.
Right.
And, oh, you need this drug? Well, who knows? Call and find out. So, I mean,
we all need our unicorns.
Yeah, I don't understand half of these commercials. I'm left at the end going, well, maybe I should call the number. Maybe I do need to ride a unicorn.
Brian, maybe if you're high, you understand the commercials better. I don't know. Maybe if you're already on the drugs.
Maybe you're on their drug, exactly.
Yeah, they're coded messages.
Then you understand, and you need more.
Exactly.
But how do we stop this from happening? I mean, where do I go? Who do I call? And what do I say to say, you know what, this is a little ridiculous. Help me.
Right. I mean, there's a couple of questions that you're asking there. And one is about commercials in general, more broadly, which is the drug industry, which, you know, projects itself as out to cure cancer, is spending all these millions or even billions of dollars on the next impotence drug and so forth, which may not be doing so much for humankind. And I think that that's a matter of public policy that is being debated in the current presidential election. I think I remember John Edwards saying in his debate against Vice President Cheney, he said, then we're going to do something about these commercials. The other issue has to do with the buying of Congress, and we focused on the use of this loophole, funneling money to these 501c nonprofit groups that aren't supposed to be primarily out there to influence elections. And there is something that you can do in that case, and that is call your congressman. Alert your congressman to this practice and ask your congressman to call the IRS and say, IRS, please take a look at this.
And what exactly is this loophole that I should be telling them to look for?
Well, first of all, if it's okay, I'll put in a plug for a website.
Go right ahead.
Direct you to the whole bit.
Go right ahead.
We set up a website that monitors these 30 501c groups at varying levels of offense. A lot of these groups aren't really doing anything wrong, but they're groups that are influencing elections that are registered under this part of the tax code.
Okay.
And the website is www.stealthpacs.org. It's stealth like the airplane and PACs like political action committees. Stealthpacs.org. And that website has reports on the front groups for the pharmaceutical industry, and it also has a report on the 30 groups' behavior as a whole, going back to 2000. And if you read those press releases, which are just a couple pages, that'll give you a real good sense of the issue and the loophole. But the loophole is that this area of the tax code wasn't set up for organizations to affect elections. You've heard so much this year about the so-called 527 groups, like the Swift Boat veterans claiming
right.
to be for truth.
Right.
Say what you want about the Swift Vote veterans. I don't happen to think they're necessarily for truth or really for truth at all, but they
I
are
call them Swift Vote veterans for libel.
That is the part of the tax code that's made for political use political speech and affecting elections. And the one thing you can say about it is they did have to reveal who their donors were, and it was because of that that folks were able to figure out very quickly that the Swift Vote group was made up of folks that were very closely connected with President Bush and Republican politics, and that allowed the public to take those considerations into account.
So Taylor, what you're saying is that this 501c, this
yes.
other way, the way the pharmaceutical companies, is actually even more pernicious, if you will, than
absolutely.
The 527s, because they don't have to say who they are.
Absolutely. And
they can say we're United Seniors and have no seniors involved at all and just be a bunch of corporations.
Or in we think in the case of United Seniors, one big trade association that's made up of corporations. But absolutely. And the question is, you know, what are you guys afraid of? And
yeah,
since our reports come out, a lot of reporters have called and have tried to look further into some of our accusations. We were able to make a really, really strong circumstantial case in terms of what pharma's contributions to these groups were, but we don't know absolutely because the groups don't have to disclose who they received their money from. And it happens that the trade association is also a 501c group,
yeah.
and a part of their tax form, which is a public document, says, who did you give grants to? And we think, as a matter of law, they do have to say who they give grants to and how much they were for, but they didn't.
They
and
just left it blank?
Each reporter, I said, call pharma and say, who did you give grants to? And then pharma always says, it's not our policy to say who we give money to.
Well, so to answer Brian's question,
yeah.
I know there's some talk about re-regulating 527s after all that happened in the political campaign. Is there also talk in Congress of regulating these 501Cs, to regulate the people who are secretly giving money to members of Congress to influence policy? Is somebody helping to do this? McCain, Feingold?
The 501Cs did come up in conversation in terms of the 527 matter.
Yeah.
And that is a really hot wire here in Washington because so many, you know, whatever it might be, 99% of 501C groups
yep.
have nothing to do with this sort of stuff.
I see.
And they don't want to be dragged into that. And then even some folks that might want to regulate the 501C groups in terms of their electioneering spending
yep.
fear that if they include them, it'll derail the 527 regulation.
So it sounds awfully complex. And then those of us that are sitting here trying to figure out what we can do about
But one thing is there are laws on the books, like I was mentioning earlier. We think as a matter of law, pharma has to disclose who it gives
okay.
money to.
And so we don't need new laws then. We just need an administration that's willing to enforce these laws.
Right, or an administration, I'm not going to go so far as to say, well, the Bush administration has muzzled the, you know, IRS's ability to move forward. It may just be a matter of awareness, but calling your congressman and saying, hey, please take a look at this. Call the IRS, tell them you take it seriously. We've alerted the IRS to this problem, but it will be Congress that motivates the IRS to say, you know, this is a priority. This is an outrage that this part of the tax code is being abused to basically pull a deception on voters.
Brian,
and this needs to be stopped.
Does that answer your question, Brian?
Yeah, just thanks, guys.
Call your member of Congress.
Yeah, I totally will. Watch out for those unicorns.
Yeah, you? I know. I'm always afraid of the unicorns. That's why I don't watch those commercials. Thanks,
hey,
Brian.
Can I tell you one funny story?
Real quick, because I got other callers on the line. Go ahead.
In a congressional district in Colorado,
yeah.
Three of these groups sent direct mail to voters praising one of the candidates, Bob Beaupre.
Uh-huh.
Each of the groups misspelled his name identically the same way.
So they're clearly working together.
They're working together, and they weren't very smart.
All right, let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Taylor Lincoln.
Hey, it's Dave from California.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I had received a message the other day, and the message has disappeared. But this the pharmaceutical company that was making the flu vaccine, I believe they're called Curon, Inc.,
it's a British company.
Curon, Inc.
Yeah.
Anyway, the message that I had gotten was that they were being penalized because they had not paid their fair share to the Republican Party. And it gave me a click-on link to go to. I went there, and I waited a long time. It never came up. Another page came up saying the page cannot be displayed. And then I went back to read my story, and the little email had disappeared. So,
Taylor, the flu vaccine is really interesting. I mean, given that we spent all this money for Homeland Security, some 36,000 Americans die of the flu each year, and now apparently half the flu vaccine's gone due to us making a mistake. Could this be related, as Dave suggests, to you know, them not giving enough funding or something like that to the Republicans?
I don't put much beneath these folks, I'll tell you. That's a psychopathic group.
What do you think, Taylor? You feel free to speculate if you like.
Well, I'm all for calling them as I see them. I don't have the expertise to talk on that subject.
Okay.
Do you have the means to see if Genron has been donating to the Republican Party or if they failed to do so?
Yeah, what about the – I mean, that would actually be an interesting thing to check. And, in fact, you could follow up and add to my blog later on. But do you know whether this particular company, the company that failed to make safe flu vaccine, we're told, were they contributing as well? How did – I mean, how do these companies get the flu vaccine? My understanding is that if we'd gone to several different companies and sort of farmed it out, we wouldn't have had this problem instead of relying all on one company. Could it be that that company is given contributions?
Well, again, I can't speak to that, but it is difficult to see a company's role in some of the campaign finance laws make it tougher because, like I say, companies can't give money directly to candidates. And so what goes on is more under the table, and then with the ban on contributions to parties, you know, it makes it even further. You know, it used to be maybe in 2002 you could see if Chiron gave money to the Republican Party, but if they want to give money now, they've got to come up with creative ways to do it or run it through one of these front groups. So it is a little bit tougher to know.
I do think it's highly unusual that we are depending entirely on one flu company, or almost entirely on one flu vaccine company for half our vaccine. I would think that just like you diversify, you know, stocks or whatever you own, so in case there's a problem, one goes bankrupt, you still don't lose all your shirt, that with flu vaccines, you would also diversify among various companies, and that it's a huge mistake to go to only one. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that one company had given a donation at the proper time. But, Dave, it looks like neither I nor Taylor can give you evidence of that.
Somebody should be able to dig this up. You know, I think on Common Cause or something, I cannot even find a company called Genron Inc. But on any search engine, but they apparently did it. So if they said to the Bush administration, we choose not to give, and then they're visited by a federal inspector who says, uh-oh, your stuff is no longer good, can't be imported. Now, they wouldn't not care in how many people that would harm.
That would be a great story, and I'd be the first to break it here, Dave, if I had a little more evidence of it. Taylor, has Public Citizen looked at the flu vaccine at all?
I haven't personally. I can't speak to that. We do have a whole medical drug practice, but they're in a different building, and it's not my area.
Okay, if you find out something, will you let me know,
I will.
Taylor? I appreciate that. Dave, we have to go to commercial break.
Thanks a million, guys.
Thank you very much for your call. When we come back, I want to talk in more detail about what they're getting, all right? We've talked about drugs in Canada, about not negotiating it. What are they getting from taxpayers? They're already getting so much money from the highest drug costs. What is the Bush administration giving them for their money? And, you know, what do you think about it? Again, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back after this.
Win the Workers Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Jesse Russell. The AFL-CIO has raised the ire of the Bush campaign by launching coordinated protests at campaign offices across the country. In a letter to John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, the Bush campaign claims that union members entered offices on October 5th and injured workers, vandalized property, and intimidated voters. The letter calls for the labor organization to immediately discontinue any coordinated protest efforts. In a statement, the AFL-CIO calls the allegations irresponsible and politically motivated. The protests were in opposition to the Bush administration's new overtime regulations. More than 200,000 postcards and petitions were delivered to the campaign offices. The Bush campaign letter also alludes to recent incidents where guns were fired at campaign offices in West Virginia, Tennessee, and Florida, but does not directly blame the AFL-CIO for the shooting incidents.
As the presidential election looms closer, Americans' prosperity has become a central campaign issue. A new report by the Working Poor Families Project throws new light on a highly charged debate. More than one quarter of all U.S. workers are paid poverty wages, and 20 million children live in families that don't earn enough to meet basic needs, according to a new report entitled Working Hard, Falling Short. Brandon Roberts, co-author of the report, says there's a huge and growing disparity between America's low-income service labor force and businesses' demand for highly skilled workers. He says there needs to be a coordinated effort between states and the federal government on programs that help low-wage workers.
9.2 million working families are low-income. These are families that are struggling to make ends meet and to advance to the middle class.
Robert says raising the minimum wage is one simple measure that could immediately lift some of the financial burden off the backs of working families.
The AFL-CIO has asked its members to oppose an amendment to the Michigan State Constitution that would ban same-sex marriage. Michigan AFL-CIO President Mark Gaffney calls the amendment a cynical and divisive ploy. He adds that the labor organization also opposes the measure because it would take away benefits that have already been negotiated into union contracts. The proposed amendment would define marriage as between one man and one woman and altogether bar recognition of domestic partnerships. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A 71% of likely voters say that outsourcing jobs overseas hurts the U.S. economy. That's according to a recent poll conducted by Zogby International for the Foreign Policy Association. Their survey also reveals that 62% of likely voters believe the U.S. government should tax or legislate against companies who engage in outsourcing. U.S. labor leaders argue that outsourcing is bad for U.S. jobs, while economists believe U.S. protectionism would be bad for the overall global economy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, exploring with Taylor Lincoln of Public Citizen the way in which the drug companies control Congress. We've talked about the tens of millions of dollars that they are secretly funneling through various front groups and how they use special ways in the tax code to get around letting us know who they are and how they're funding members of Congress. But the question is, what do you get back? I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble of buying a member of Congress and putting him or her in your pocket, what are you going to get for it? And one of the things that, in fact, one of the people wrote on my blog, James, and by the way, you feel still some time to call in if you wish, 877-57-SCOOP, but you can also write into the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. James did a little research on Pfizer, and he notes that Pfizer helped sponsor a night of comedy, music, and fun in honor of Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, a member of the Senate Health Committee. I should note that Senator Dodd is a Democrat, but someone whose seat is absolutely not in trouble. He's a solid seat. But he also points out that Pfizer has a major research facility in Connecticut. Meanwhile, Pfizer's chief executive, Hank McKinnell, raised at least $200,000 for Bush's reelection campaign, and the company's on the host committee for the GOP's upcoming presidential convention in New York. What was upcoming at the time this was written? The point is that they are giving out lots of money, doling out the money. What are they getting for it? Well, we know from the Medicare bill, we know that they are getting that the government will not negotiate better prices. You would think that the government, being the largest buyer of health care through Medicare and everything else, would use that power on behalf of American citizens to negotiate lower drug prices. Not only is the government not doing it, but the new Medicare law forbids the government, actually refuses to allow the government to negotiate better prices. It is illegal for the government to do some bargaining with these drug companies. If they want to charge $1,000 a pill, they can go right ahead. That's quite a lot of money for drug companies to pocket. And the other thing, of course, is they don't allow reimportation from Canada. In other words, these same American drug companies can sell drugs to Canada, which, by the way, does allow negotiation of cheaper prices. They sell it to Canadians at cheaper prices, but it is illegal, because the Bush administration wants it to be illegal, for Americans to go over to Canada and buy those drugs at a cheaper price and bring them home. And what's interesting is that George Bush, in the last debate, said, oh, well, that's because of safety issues. He's concerned that Canada, being the third world country, I guess, that Bush thinks it is going to give us unsafe drugs. James wrote the blog. Taylor, from Public Citizen, I don't know if you've studied this, but is there anything behind this suggestion that drugs from Canada aren't safe?
At Public Citizen, actually, we do have a mixed view on that because drug safety has been a huge issue of ours.
Okay.
What I would simply add to that discussion is the footage that's been shown in the past week of President Bush, then Governor Bush, in his debate against Al Gore in 2000. And when asked the question of reimportation of drugs in Canada, he said that sounds like a good idea. Well, in the most recent debate, I think that he said he might have an update in December if he's reelected. So we've gone, 4 years and a couple months between a good idea and then some sort of an update on getting that good idea enacted.
Well, you know, some would call that a flip-flop, but I wouldn't use such language because I think that's really offensive language for a person who has simply changed his position from one favoring the American people to favoring the drug companies.
But he's saying that there's a chance that he might favor the American people again in December.
Well,
if he's reelected.
Yeah, after his, and I never say reelected, I might say reselected.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be in complete depression, I'll probably be using some of these mind-altering drugs if I have to, if George Bush is actually becomes president again. But if he does, I do think it's very interesting that he's saving that until after the election to
right.
make that decision.
But maybe, again, even if it didn't happen in December, maybe 3.5 years from December, the candidates could promise it again, if you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, I understand. He'll promise it every 4 years. Every Republican will promise it every 4 years. One of the things I found most interesting about the drug bill is that seniors apparently can start seeing benefits in 2006 for a bill that was passed in 2004, but drug companies get benefits right away. Is that accurate? Am I getting that right here, Taylor?
Well, elaborate on that. How are they getting the benefits right away?
I understand that there's actually federal money going to the drug companies in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Is that fair?
Again, I'm not an expert on the drug bill beyond these certain benefits.
All right.
I
won't press you. Then let me ask you another question that I get from a blogger. And he writes that he thinks one of the big problems is what is commonly referred to as the revolving door.
Yes.
So many lobbyists are former members of Congress or the government, and so many members of government are former lobbyists. And he writes, I know Bush has made a habit of appointing people who were lobbyists in the past, many times to positions where they would regulate the exact industry they were representing and being compensated by.
Right.
Is that going on in the health field? Do we have people?
There certainly is. A couple good examples from that is that in 2003, the drug industry spent more than $100 million on lobbying to employ more than 800 lobbyists.
Okay.
And of those, 30 were former members of Congress.
Okay.
So there are a lot of members of Congress that have gone to lobby their former peers to pass bills such as the Medicare prescription drug bill.
Now, a few years back, we passed a law that would stop that. I believe there's at least you have to wait a year.
You have to wait a year,
and
right.
then they go into it. So,
right.
would Public Citizen advocate waiting 5 years or 10 years? Or frankly, I don't know. I don't know that we should allow former members of Congress to lobby at all. If the American people have chosen you as a member of Congress and you're no longer there, I think you need to get another gig. Be a lawyer. Go be a farmer.
Well, it certainly is a bit repugnant to the notion of democracy that one would leave a public service job paying $130,000 or $150,000 a year and walk across the street and start making $500,000 a year or $1 million a year doing things that aren't really at all in the public interest but are in the interest of these special interests.
Well, let me give a secret, and this is based on when I worked in Congress, and my boss, Barney Frank, made it clear to me that, lobbyists, it doesn't really matter. We don't have to spend time with them. If there's a constituent, if it's someone who is from the district, sure, we have to listen to them. If it's an issue, we should hear them out. It's not that we excluded lobbyists,
right.
But for Barney Frank and for, I think, many members of Congress, many Democrats, it's just a question of bring us your ideas. And it doesn't matter who's doing it. It's just a question of the ideas. I happen to think that's the minority view. I'm afraid that most members of Congress do listen to these big lobbyists. I mean, what are the lobbyists being paid for? If you're given $500,000...
That's a big question, isn't
to
it?
A former member of Congress.
Right.
$500,000. Either that money's being wasted, in which case, $500,000 is being thrown out the window and you need to tell the corporation spending the money to, if you're a shareholder, don't waste my money. Or they're buying influence. They are using legalized bribery. Now, I don't know which is worse, the criminal act of legalized bribery or the incompetent use of money, but I'll tell you one thing. I don't think these big corporations would be spending this kind of cash unless they thought they were getting something back.
I think that that's a pretty good – there's an example of John McCain one time sat down with a couple of lobbyists, and after the lobbyists left, he was questioned about it, and they had been contributors to his campaign.
Right.
And he said, you're right. I wouldn't have met with these people if they hadn't been contributors. And it was his way of saying, shame on me. But the point is, he was somebody who was willing to say, boy, that's how things have gotten to be around here, and it shouldn't be that way. And I don't think there's many John McCains walking around the halls of Congress.
No, there really aren't. And there aren't many people that are going around supporting what I support and what I think you support as well, Taylor, and that is public financing of campaigns. Let's finally break the back, break the connection between buying members of Congress and getting something back.
But, you know, there have been benefits. You know, the McCain-Feingold bill has one thing that it's resulted in is a great deal less overall corporate contributions to the political process,
okay,
which is something that is welcomed by the taxpayers because you've got less buying of special interest favors. It's also welcomed by the corporations because there's less incumbents on them to pay up.
They call it the shakedown in Congress.
Exactly.
What happens is the leaders of, and I got to say, it tends to be the Republicans more than the Democrats. They go to, say, the pharmaceutical companies, and they say, you know, Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House, he could really use $1 million to help out this Republican struggling in his campaign in Illinois. And la, 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 la. And by the way, that drug bill could give you a lot of money for research. My friends, this is legalized bribery. It may be legal, but I don't care whether it is or it isn't. It's bribery, and it's something that's affected both parties, but more the Republicans than the Democrats, and it's something that if we get a new president and a new Congress, hopefully we can put a stop to.
Hey, can I point out something your listeners can do to help?
You can, and you got about 30 seconds to do it.
All righty. These groups will probably try a big push in the last couple of weeks to help their members of Congress by sending out direct mail, telemarketing calls, and who knows what that we haven't thought of. They can't be on television this year because of the recent McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill. My request is, if you get an example of an ad from 60 Plus or USA or the Seniors Coalition, go to our website, www.stealthpacts.org, and hit the Contact Us button and let us know about it. And that way we can get the word out to the public that this attempt to sway the election by deceptive messages, it can be at least revealed to the press and we can get the word out about what's going on.
Taylor, that's a great idea. I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank you very much for coming on the Inside
Scoop. It's been a pleasure.
Scoop.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow. We're going to go talk about the debate that's tonight. Everyone listening to my voice should listen to the debate tonight. I really think it is the chance for John Kerry to break out of the pack. We're going to talk about it in detail tomorrow. And then Friday, we're going to talk about Sinclair Broadcasting, which is breaking campaign laws to force its local